On the 14th of May, 1943, a torpedo slammed into the hospital ship Centaur off the coast of Australia. It sank to the bottom of a watery grave of about 7,000 feet. The evening before, the captain had turned all the lights on this white ship with a big blue stripe painted around it, with two big red crosses on the sides and up the smokestacks. He wanted to make sure that everybody at that time in that part of the world understood that this was under the Geneva Convention, a vessel that would not be attacked. All of those signs and the lights themselves didn't matter to Japanese commander of the submarine I-117. When he surfaced about 4 a.m. in the morning looking at this lit up ship and seeing that it was a hospital ship, it didn't really bother him, so he slammed the torpedo into the port side of the ship. It exploded down into the bowels of the ship, and in about 10 minutes it went down with most all of the 350 wounded and maimed soldiers that thought they had their ticket home. Most everyone else, too, with the crew, the nurses, the doctors, everyone else, the stewards on board, went down to a watery grave. There are a few survivors, however, one of them being a nurse. She had just been talking to her friends several minutes before, and they were discussing what they were going to do after the war when they got home. And then this ship exploded and began to go down into the watery darkness. And so she put on a life vest. She had never swam before, knew she couldn't, and then she jumped with all of her friends. When she finally fought her way up out of the vortex of the suction of the ship, none of her friends were there. All the other nurses went down. She was the sole survivor of that little group. Later on, she would make her way to this raft that they called Survival Island, which is a raft for about 15 individuals, but they had about 36 people on it and hanging all over it. She joined that raft. She never did complain that she had broken ribs, a broken nose, ruptured eardrums, and a fractured palate from the depths that she had been plummeted to. Instead, she saw other people in need, and she began to try to bolster their morale, and as planes would go overhead the next day and not see them, their spirits would just plunge. Then they would be demoralized by the sharks that were spinning around them and kind of looking at them and intimidating them. And sometimes these individuals, after about 48 hours, would start running out of water and be dehydrated. And they would start talking about getting a fresh drink. And so they'd let go of the raft and just swim off, never to be saw, you know, never be seen again. She would start singing hymns to them. And some of the individuals that died on the raft, she would actually pray over the body before they cut it loose and let it go down into the ocean. Later on, when they were rescued, every one of the individuals on Survival Island talked about Sister Ellen Savage. They said, you know what, maybe that she was the key to their survival, that somehow she had just enabled them. Sometimes she spoke harshly to people when they were getting out of control, and sometimes she let individuals just cry on her shoulder. She was the only woman to survive. If you think about what was going on in the 1940s and how women were supposed to behave and how they were not supposed to behave, what they were thought to be and what they were thought not to be, this was going to be a remarkable story. She receives the George Medal from the Queensland or Australia, which is the second woman to ever receive that medal for extreme heroism. But everybody had the same story about Ellen Savage. Leadership is not a position. Oh, there are positions of leadership. We know that. But leadership is about where life finds you and what influence you have on other people through your character. You know, I've heard leadership being defined as, well, it's influencing other people to do what they otherwise wouldn't do. That's some of leadership, but that doesn't distinguish between Adolf Hitler and Winston Churchill, does it? And there's a big difference. I like to think of leadership as moral character, acting with conviction upon a vision, and even that falls short, but it's somewhere to start. And one of the greatest leaders we ever read about, maybe one of the greatest leaders of all time in the world, was Moses. I think some people don't understand what he was up against, what kind of challenges Moses had as a leader with over 1 million people coming out of slavery that had never been free. If you don't think that's a challenge, going into the wilderness with no kind of government, no kind of background, nobody to nurture them, nobody to model themselves after, just a group of people over 1 million strong suddenly cut loose from bondage. Moses had his hands full, but he was an incredibly great leader. But as we see, he's not going to be able to take these people into the promised land. He's going to have to hand off what we call the guidon of leadership. That's every military unit has a guidon. It's a flag on a staff. It's the colors in your insignia. It's probably what people wear as a patch on their arm. And then a change of command ceremony would be one commander handing this guidon over to the other, saying, it's all up to you now. And that's what you see happening in Numbers, and particularly in Deuteronomy. When Moses begins to charge the people and the next leader, take heed unto yourselves and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, lest they depart out of your heart all the days of thy life. And let them be known, or make them be known unto thy children and thy children's children. In Deuteronomy 4:9, it's a charge to every single individual in the congregation to influence those people around and pick up some kind of charge of leadership to make sure that what we have considered the legacy of faith is passed on. And he says, don't forget, O Israel, what does Jehovah thy God require of thee? But to fear Jehovah thy God, and to walk in all his ways, and to love him, and to serve Jehovah thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul, and to keep the commandments of Jehovah and his statutes, which I've commanded you this day, for thy good. And in Deuteronomy chapter 10, verse 12 and 13, he tells the entire congregation, some of these last words, don't forget, this is your job. This is your purpose as an individual. And at that point, he begins to pass on that guidon over to a man named Hoshea. You will have met Hoshea when he had a sword and a shield in his hand, and he met the Amalekites as a young man. He was strong and fierce. Later on, you would meet him as he would go in to spy out the land. And instead of seeing giants, he saw opportunity. Unlike his counterparts, his name would be changed to Yeshua. You see, Hoshea means salvation or help. Yeshua would be a contraction in the Hebrew language. It would mean Jehovah is our help. He is our salvation. And he would have a fourfold mission. He would have to prepare the people. He would have to go in and conquer the land because Moses would not be there any longer. And then he would have to allocate the land, divide it up, and then he would have to consecrate the land. Now, I think Joshua is one of the unsung heroes. I think he's totally underrated for singleness of purpose, for direction, and for decision. Decision has been said to be the essence of leadership. And for all of that, Joshua is a giant. Israel never apostatizes under a Joshua. You think about it. This is a stiff-necked people. When did they apostatize under Joshua? He takes this off. And how would you like to be the guy that sees Moses coming to you with the guide on, the greatest leader maybe the world's ever seen? He says, you know what? I'm going to give it to you now. Maybe a lot of people wouldn't even want to pick that one up. But Joshua is going to do an outstanding, superb job. So we pick up the reading in Joshua chapter 1 and verse 1. Now it came to pass on the death of Moses, the servant of Jehovah, that Jehovah spake unto Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' minister, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise and go over this Jordan, thou and all this people, into the land that I do give to them, even the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot shall tread upon, to you have I given it, as I spake unto Moses. And from this wilderness unto the Lebanon, unto the great river, the river Euphrates, and all the land of the Hittites over here into the great sea of the going down of the sun shall be your border. There shall not be any man that be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so also I shall be with you. I will not fail thee nor forsake thee. Be strong and of good courage, for thou shalt cause this people to go over and inherit the land which I swear unto their fathers to give to them. Only be strong and very courageous to observe to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded thee. Depart not from it to the right hand or to the left, that thou mayest have good success whithersoever thou goest. This book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth. Thou shalt meditate thereon day and night, that thou observe to do according to all that is written therein. And then thou shalt make thy way prosperous. And then thou shalt have good success. Have not I commanded thee? Be strong and of good courage. Be not affrighted, neither be dismayed. For Jehovah thy God is with thee whithersoever thou goest. There's about five things I'd like to point out with this passage as Joshua picks up this guide on and God himself commissions Joshua. First of all, notice, every time God speaks of Moses, he says, my servant Moses. You notice that? He can hardly speak the name without saying, my servant Moses. Oh, I know, we speak about, you know, one day, enter in thou good and faithful servant. But no, he knows him by name, and he doesn't name him without describing him. And he says, my servant Moses. Your whole purpose in life, my whole purpose in life, is to come to that sunset, to come to the Jordan River, in the inn that Mike was talking about this morning with his parents, to be known as servants of Jehovah, that Jehovah would know you that way, my servant Moses. If he doesn't know you that way, he doesn't know you. Moses was one of the meekest men in all the earth. He says he was meeker more than anyone on the face of the earth. Great leadership requires meekness, never weakness. They're two different things. We think they're the same. They don't have anything to do with each other. Meekness, we have been described before as a captain that stands on the hurricane deck of a ship. In the midst of the storm, when everybody else is losing their mind and the adrenaline is pumping through you because you got this fight or flight, but it's the captain that stands there and calls out the commands, knows what needs to be done, when it needs to be done, and he's cool, calm, and collected and just taking care of the business. Meekness is incredible strength of self-control. When Jesus was thrown down on the cross and nails hammered into him, it was God's power. He created the universe in one word and yet chose not to do anything. When you're a small kid and you got a bunch of bullies that come after you and they start picking on you and you start shaking in your shoes and you turn around and run away. See, that's not meekness. That is being afraid. When you're a big, strong man and a little guy comes up and tries to do the Hitler complex with you and he's picking on you, you know you could smash him like a 10-penny nail, and then you choose to walk away, that's meekness. Meekness is total self-control when everybody else around you is losing it because of fight or flight. You know, Simon Sinek would come out to officer training school sometime. He goes out there to Maxwell. He's written all those bestsellers that you read about. You see him in the airports, you know, that start with why, or leaders that, you know, eat last, those kind of things. But if you listen to Simon Sinek, he talks about servant leadership. And that's the great model everybody's talking about now, the very effective model of servant leadership. If you're a leader, you have to serve those people in your organization, in your entity. And you know, everybody's getting excited about this servant leadership thing. It's effective not because the world has discovered it, but because that's the way God set the world up. He set it up. It's like an eternal moral law that your greatness comes from serving other people. And for the Christian, are you surprised? Are you shocked? Or have we been talking about this for 2,000 years since Luke 22, 24 through 27? When Jesus is there with his disciples, and what do they say? There was a contention that rose among them. Which of them was accounted to be the greatest? That's what I want to know, by the way. I want to know which one of us are greatest. That's what I want to get to. And he says, the kings of the Gentiles have lordship over them. And they that have authority over them are called benefactors. But you shall not be so. He said, but he that is greater, let him become as the younger. And he that is chief, as he that serves. For which is greater, he that sitteth at meat or he that serves? It's not he that sitteth at meat. But I am in the midst of you as one that serves. Now I want you to think about that. God in the flesh, the most powerful imagination you have, creating the universe in one word, standing in the midst of his disciples, that says, I am. Now, how many I am sermons have you heard? We go to John 6, we go to John 10. Have we ever gone to Luke 22? This is one of the greatest I am statements in all the Gospels. I am in the midst of you, he that serves. So Jesus has been talking about servant leadership for a long time, hasn't he? And it's about what Mike Moody was talking about. I don't even like Mike as a teacher, because every time he teaches and I get up to preach, he's already beaten me to the punch. And he's already thrown his punches out there. He's talking about humility this morning. Just an excellent job. 1 Peter 5 and 5 and 6. This is what Peter says too. He says, but let the younger be subject unto the elder. Yea, and all of you gird yourself with what? Humility to do what? Serve one another. For God resisteth the proud, giveth grace unto the humble. For humble yourself under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. Servant leadership. Number two, you cannot see that passage in Joshua without understanding that the land is a gift. Jericho, part of the land and the conquering, is a gift from God. Unto you have I given it. Unto your fathers have I sworn to give it. I give it to you. It is a gift. In fact, I believe the Bible speaks about the land promise being a gift more than any other gift of grace that God has. It is a type and a shadow. We'll talk about that in a second, of a reality to come, and it is a gift. And if they didn't understand that on day one, marching around when he said, shut your mouth, put your sandals on, march around the city. And they're down there. The city's up on a hill. It's looking down on them. They're not looking up at the Israelites getting afraid at this point. They're looking down. And here they are, silently marching around, seven horns, rams, being blown by the priest. Nothing makes sense. And on day one, you think, well, this is, yeah, hey, this is pretty fun. Day two, you're thinking, what in the world's going on? Day three and four, pretty soon it soaks into you. This has nothing to do with you. God wanted the Israel. He didn't care what the people in Jericho thought. They're going to be burned alive in about 3 or 4 days. I mean, they're about to go down and they're going to cease to exist. This is for the Israelites. To understand that the city was a gift. And in Joshua chapter 6, he said, see, I've given it into your hand, Jericho. There wasn't one person in that entire procession that thought they had anything to do with the walls falling down. And in Hebrew, the Hebrew writer, in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 30, he says, by faith, the walls of Jericho fell down after they'd been compassed of 7 days. Okay, so it's the grace of God. By God's grace, he brought the walls down. By faith, the walls were brought down. There was no works involved in bringing the walls down other than the work that he required them to do, but they didn't fall by works. It was a gift. But there were people there in that congregation that said, you know what? Listen, Joshua, I know what it sounded like he said, but it can't be that way because it's a gift. Therefore, if we walk around, that's going to be falling by works. So listen, it's not that. We cannot walk around these walls because then it won't be by the grace of God. So they refused to walk around the walls. Then there were others there that said, no, listen, hey, he heard him say walk around the walls. But listen, this is the way it's going to go. We'll wait for God. His grace will bring the walls down, and then we will march around them for an outward sign of an inward faith. Because there's no way we can march around to cause the walls to fall, because then it would be by works, not grace. See, we're confusing what God's Word says with the TV evangelist, with the Calvinist, with the denominational doctrine, with the... You know, this is what my grandmother taught me. These are good people across the street. These are great religious people across town. That, okay, we got people here that say, you know what? Somebody refused to walk around the walls of Jericho, and you still think they're an Israelite in good standing. Wrong. You tell me what would have happened if they wouldn't have walked around the wall. Said, no, we're not doing that. You had to heard that wrong. How about we take AI as an example? You go to AI, let's just send 3,000 people. Little city, we got this. We did so well with Jericho. 3,000 go up there, turn tail, tail run in front of their enemies. 36 of them are killed. Joshua drops in the dirt in his face in front of God. And he sits there in front of the ark. And God lets him do that all day long. And then he comes to him and what does he do? You know, oh, sorry, Joshua. I know things are not turning out the way. No, he said, get up. Why art thou falling upon thy face? I told you. You have taken of the devoted thing. You have sinned. You have polluted. And he said, someone has stolen. Who did they steal it from? The people in Jericho? They stole a Babylonish garment, 200 shekels of silver? No, they didn't steal it from them. They stole it from God. And the disobedience brings the wrath of God. And it disallows the gift, because the gift was going to be the land and the cities, but it was all contingent upon the obedience of faith in every case. And that brings us to our next point. What in the world is the devoted thing? You know, we talk about this a lot. We see it in Bible classes. We say, what is the devoted thing? Well, it's good enough. When God said, you obey. Should be good enough. Sometimes we want to know why. Sometimes we want to question. No, it's not ours to question. God said, then we obey. But as a leader, if you explain why, people are more apt to be able to do better at their job. They perform better. They innovate more. They're on board with you. They have ownership. They understand. Why the devoted thing? Is God just throwing a test out there? It's all we learn is when God said you need to obey. That's a good lesson, but it's deeper than that. And I'm going to show you it applies to us very, very richly. Jericho was the first fruits of the conquering. Oh, wait a minute. Where did we read about that? God has always demanded the firstborn. He demands the first fruits. He demanded the first of the harvest, the best you have, the pure of the flock, the unblemished. Always. Has he ever been satisfied with less than the best? Has he ever been satisfied with less than your best? Have you read through Malachi chapter 1 lately? Why don't you do that on a rainy afternoon? There were those people there. They had their flocks and their herds. And you know, he said, you know what? You give me the lame. You give me the blind. You gave me the sick. He said, you think I'm going to be pleased with that? You want me to be pleased with that? He says, you're offering up vain fire on my altar. Get it out of me. Just get it away. He's never been pleased. When he said Jericho, it's the first fruits. Later on, he goes, take some of the spoils. You're all right. That's what it's all about. Go take some of it. Take AI down. Take some of the spoils for yourself. That's how we're going to get this thing done. But not the first fruits. See, I just paid my car payment. I paid my house payment. Paid my insurance policy. Make sure my 401k is all done. I like to go out to eat, so I got a little bit set aside for that. No, I like to do a little vacation once in a while, too. We do all that, buy some presents. Everything's going well. And then when all that's done, I got this left over, and I'm a cheerful giver. You come in here with your flip-flops on, you come in here with your shorts, your t-shirts and all that. You say, well, where's the verse that says, we can't do that? It's not about a verse, it's about an attitude. It's about an attitude, who you're coming before and how you see God. God says, I demand your best. I always have, always will. That brings us to our next point, and that is, everything in the Old Testament is a shadow of the reality come. It is a type of learning for us in the New Testament. Every bit of it, as Paul told the Corinthians in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I would not have you ignorant, brethren, that our fathers all were under the cloud and all passed through the sea. And we're all baptized unto Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And they all ate of the same spiritual food. And they all drank of the same spiritual drink. They drank of a spiritual rock that followed them. That rock was Christ. Howbeit, God was not well pleased with most of them, for they were overthrown in the wilderness. Now, these things were our examples. That word is type. That's a pattern of learning. It is a type. We are supposed to learn from... You know, I told you this before. I want to remind you. I preached a sermon like this. We had just Old Testament passages, and a guy came up to me afterwards. He said, well, that was really good preaching, but he goes, you know, we're New Testament Christians. You never went to the New Testament. I said, yeah. He said, but we're New Testament Christians. You just stayed in the Old Testament. I said, yeah, right. He just, and he couldn't get, and finally I said, what are you saying? He said, well, you know, it's been nailed to the cross. What part's been nailed to the cross? In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. The earth was out form and void. Darkness upon the face of the deep. Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. That's been all nailed to the cross. You know what I think? I think of postmodern America, people are walking in here and they're saying, you know what we learned from the Old Testament? Boy, aren't you glad we're not under the God of the Old Testament? We got sobering news, don't we? You are under the God of the Old Testament. There's no such thing. There was an old covenant and there was a new covenant. But Genesis 1:1 to Revelation 22:21 is about God and God's revealing himself in the Old Testament of who he is. He's not revealing somebody that says, hey, I want you to learn that you don't want me to be this way. God's the same. That's the God you are serving. It's the one that was there that says, take Achan out, stone him, burn his things and pile a rubble around him. You know, this is kind of hard to understand, and I know it's Jake Armstrong and I were talking the other day. We kind of were wrestling with this idea, just kind of speaking out loud to each other, thinking out loud. And I won't be able to explain it all to you, but maybe the best way to think about it is, let's put it in a different context. You rewind yourself and go back to 800 BC. You're not seeing people killed for sin every day. You would look around and see total nations raping and pillaging and burning and doing whatever they wanted. You would see your Israelite neighbors being idolaters. They would be doing all kind of things. And you'd be like, well, God's mercy and grace is incredible. He's just allowing all these things to happen. His love is so long-suffering. What you're reading with Achan and Nadab and Abihu, those are isolated incidents. And why? For our learning, for an example, so that we could understand God and how he feels about sin and disobedience. But taken as a whole, you could go 1,000 years and never see that. Okay, and the other context is you fast forward. Day of judgment. We're standing in front of the Bema, the judgment seat of Christ. And you're watching loved ones and friends and good people and good neighbors. And you hear Jesus saying, hey, depart from me, I never knew you. Accursed into a lake of fire that's prepared for the devil and his angels, where a fire will not be quenched, where a worm will not die. And then at that point, are you going to stand there and say, boy, I'm glad we're not under the God of the Old Testament? Or are we going to understand more about how God feels about sin and why the reconciliation on the cross needed to happen? It's the same God. Same God. That brings me to my last point. The God that you serve, is that God able to bring the walls of Jericho down today? You remember one time we were talking and I said, do you believe that in 1 Kings chapter 6, or 2 Kings chapter 6, that do you believe that Elisha's servant looked up and saw horses and chariot fire round about Elisha? I'm not asking you whether you believe that the walls of Jericho came down. I'm not asking that. We know they did. Dr. Garstang went there in 1928, said, yes, those walls are down. 6 feet thick on the outside, toppled down the hill, 15 feet in between them with houses built in there, and then 12 feet thick walls on the inside, and all of them 18 feet high with archers and catapult parapets and all of that, and a 10-foot thick ash layer that's unseen of, like nothing in Palestine to match it. He said it was a conflagration that just, somebody must have been feeding a fervent fire for several days to get 10 feet thick of ash. Something brought those walls down. Something burnt that city down in about 1400, 1450 BC. So we know the walls came down. That's not what I'm asking. I'm asking, is the wall you serve, the God that I serve, will he and can he bring the walls of Jericho down today? And you say, oh, no, wait a minute, Colonel, you've gone too far. You've gone too far. There's a difference between the miraculous and there's a difference between, you know, providence. And okay, listen now. In a miracle, sometimes the miracle is the result itself. Sometimes you can point them out. The result itself is miraculous. But most of the time, the miracle is not what, it's the how he did it. It's not the what he did, it's the how. And we know the miracles have ceased. We were told they would. We don't see them today. The purpose for them is over. We've been over that before. So get rid of that smoke screen out of your mind. Let me ask the question again. Is the God you serve able to bring the wall of Jericho down today? Can he? Will he? Is he the same God or not? Are those promises to his people that Jehovah thy God will be with thee whithersoever thou goest? Be not affrighted, neither be thou dismayed. Be strong and be of courage. Or is it a different God? Will the vision of your family in 5, 10, 15 years be different if you knew that God would bring the walls of Jericho down today? Would the vision for this church be different in the eldership's mind if they knew that God would bring the walls of Jericho down today? Would the vision for yourself as an individual and what you can accomplish be different if you knew that God said, be strong and of good courage. I will never forsake thee. As I was with Moses, I will be with thee. The only thing that we have to make sure of is that we are in the Israelite army, that we are the Israel of God. And there was only one way to do that. In the preparation phase, after they crossed the Jordan, Joshua had to stop them right there. And he said, you cannot, you will not, we won't go through, we cannot continue to be the covenant people of God because you're uncircumcised. And it was a requirement right before they went into war to maim themselves and injure themselves. And they did it. Because God wasn't going to have them outside the covenant relationship. And that's exactly what he demands today. To be the Israel of God is circumcision. That's what Paul told the church at Colossae. To be circumcised with a circumcision not made with hands in the putting off of the body of the flesh, but in the circumcision of Christ, having been baptized with him, having been buried with him, so that you also may be raised up through faith in the working of God who raised him from the dead. Outside of that, you are not in the congregation of Israel. You cannot proceed and march around the walls of Jericho. You cannot proceed and take the promised land. You cannot be outside of a covenant relationship with God and expect that his grace will come to you outside of the obedience of faith. We need to be more like Joshua and grab that guide on and not only hold tight onto it, begin to run with it and lead each other and the people of God to victory that Jesus Christ is waiting to give to you. If you have any need this morning to be able to come into that covenant relationship with God, to be able to join the Israel of God, the church that Jesus died for and purchased with his own blood, or anything else that we can help you with, we invite you to come forward as we